Welcome to the Ferris Love Podcast. Here we explore spiritual insights and practical strategies to help you cultivate a family life rooted in beautiful, self-giving love. Join us as we invite experts to share uplifting perspectives and actionable advice for navigating the joys and challenges of modern family dynamics. Welcome back to the Ferris Love Podcast. Today, we're joined by Victor Sines, Executive Director of the Houston Institute. With a PhD in philosophy from Rice University, Victor Sines specializes in ancient Greek philosophy, particularly Aristotle's ethics and psychology. And at the Institute, he leads initiatives that encourage students and faculty to engage deeply with questions about human flourishing and the good life. And so today in our conversation, we're going to explore a little bit about how college students, you know, perceive traditional family and marriage values and how those concepts can sort of evolve through some of the work that he has done and how we can, you know, build a better understanding of that human experience. So Victor, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Gary Grace. I'm excited for the conversation.
Yes. So we would love to know a little bit more about this, you yourself, as well as this Houston Institute that you are the executive director of.
Yes, of course. So let me start with the second of those. So the Houston Institute is an independent academic nonprofit. Its mission is to help people of Rice and the broader Houston community to think deeply about the best way to live through the study of the liberal arts, especially philosophy and literature. And our work is really animated by three core convictions or ideas. So the first is just the recognition that people and young people in particular are having a hard time having moral conversations. And I think especially about moral conversations across ideological lines. So think about when people are having conversations across political lines or sometimes across religious lines or sometimes conversations that challenge some of the most deeply held convictions. So it's very much our view that college is a place for those conversations to happen, and we think there should be more of them. So that's one core idea. A second core idea is also the recognition that young people need, especially in a college setting, need more exposure to, you know, what you might call the great thinkers. You know, the best that has been said and thought in the human experience. So some of these thinkers include people like, you know, Homer and, you know, Plato and Sophocles, or people like Augustine or Aquinas, but even people like Nietzsche or Marx or Sartre, right? So even some of these are people that I think are onto something really important and insightful. Some of these are people that I think are really wrong in really crucial ways, but I think all of these are people that I have something to learn from, right? And and it is, have all been thinkers that have impacted how we think about the human experience. So that's the second core idea, that we need more exposure to some of these thinkers. And the third idea is that we should be doing more thinking about what it means to flourish as a human being. So what it means to thrive. So here, thinkers like Aristotle and Aquinas are kind of constant companions in this journey. So in thinking about flourishing, we're thinking about things like questions of character, you know, virtue and vice. So things like that. And we really think that thinkers like Aristotle and Aquinas have enduring insights to help us think about these questions. So that's super big picture about Houston Institute. We try to carry out that vision by running reading groups, public lectures. We do public debates, things like that. We also do programming in addition to stuff for Rice University students and for university students more broadly in the Houston area. We also do stuff for members of the community. So that's a little bit about Houston Institute. Now, with that, so let me say a little bit about me. So I think I probably encountered something that looked like philosophy first time, probably sometime in high school. I couldn't have told you what philosophy was, but I went to a small Catholic high school on along the U.S.-Mexico border. So I'm from the border. So my house was about four blocks from the actual physical border. So it's like, walk four blocks, there's a fence. This is Mexico. Yes. That's the U.S. type of situation. Wow. So small Catholic school on the U.S. side of the border, run by religious sisters from Guadalajara. And I had this really terrific religion teacher. So he had this thing every Friday that he would call Open Line Friday, where he would basically encourage students to ask anything about anything with respect to the Catholic faith. And I kid you not, Mary Grace, like I think every question, every week, I came in with typed questions. So I had all these questions, right? I'm just like trying to understand, right? I couldn't have told you what philosophy was, right? But already that high school teacher was encouraging me to think philosophically, right? And to think philosophically as a person of faith. So I think that was just a really, really valuable experience for me. And I went on to study philosophy in college and in graduate school, and happy and still sometimes shocked to be an employed philosopher. So here we are.
Yes. Oh, that's great. And I love how you actually, if you think about both your background and then also this Houston Institute, the Houston Institute sounds like it's just a place where, you can ask those questions and help. And so in this conversation, we're hoping to kind of just discuss, like, because you have those reading groups, you have those different events and activities for people to better understand themselves. We're going to talk a little bit about kind of those experiences that you've had. So this is at Rice University, and you have, students coming to participate in these lectures and these different things. What have you noticed based on that population of those students coming to you? What have you noticed that, like, kind of are their perceptions or their just ideas about family life, family structures or beliefs? That you address, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I should also add, Mary Grace, so one experience that I haven't mentioned that's also relevant for this conversation. So also for about 5 years, I was also teaching part-time at the Rice Philosophy Department. So I was teaching, mostly courses in Plato and Aristotle, which is my area of specialization, but I was also teaching courses in the philosophy of religion. And I taught one course that is really kind of near and dear to my heart, one semester focused on respectful disagreement. And we focused very much on some of these questions of marriage and family in that context. Mm-hmm. So I've got a couple of stories that might be of interest given our conversation here. But so all that is background. But to your question, so what are some of the beliefs that I notice or that I perceive that students often tend to have about marriage and family? So I think often students seem to have a conception of marriage that looks something like this. So a marriage is a relationship of two people that's primarily an emotional union. And you might think about this as your relationship with your number one person, wherever that happens to be. Couple that with whatever kind of sexual practices that the partners might find agreeable, and children optional. So that's I think that's more or less the vision of marriage and family that a lot of young people have. And this is even people who have some fairly traditional convictions. So of course that's very different from what has been, in many ways a historically dominant view of marriage, which is marriage as this union that has an intrinsic link to children. So it inherently linked to children, and governed by norms of permanence and exclusivity, right? So this is what you might call, the conjugal conception of marriage. And clearly this is a conception of marriage that necessarily and by definition is between a man and a woman, and again, with this intrinsic link to children. So again, I think these are just very different understandings of marriage, but I think many students tend to have the first conception and not the second. If that makes sense.
And then when they come, let's say they come to a reading, or you have book clubs or things like that, like a lecture. You also said debates, which I think is pretty cool. I wonder,
happy to tell you about that. It's great.
Yeah. How they approach, and you also mentioned, like, you have different philosophical writers. Obviously you have the Plato and the Aristotle and all those classics that we're like, yes, we get behind. Then you have the Nietzsche's who are kind of like, oh, I don't know, do you see those students interacting with that, with those thinkers in this context of marriage and family life that might challenge them a little bit?
So that's great. So I think here A place where we really did some of this head on, and this wasn't really a Houston Institute thing. This was a Victor in the Classroom thing. Was so this course focused on reasonable disagreements. So for some context, so we ran that course in the fall of 2020. So you might remember there was a thing or two going on in 2020, and my running joke for the class was something like, okay, so apparently, COVID is too controversial to talk about, so let's talk about sex instead. So, of course, the students were
Yeah,
like, "Okay,
that's
let's
true.
do it." So no. So I think that the way I thought about that class is more or less fairly similar to the way I tend to think about addressing, quote unquote, hot button or difficult issues, including issues in marriage and family, is that in those contexts where I know that students are coming from very different places. In contrast to when we're dealing with students, for example, who are mostly Christian, so that the in a context where students are coming from such very different places, my default is to say something like this. What is my role in this conversation? My role in this conversation is to be a moderator of a debate. So I'm going to give you the strongest arguments on a range of sides of really important issues. So going back to the course on reasonable disagreement, I framed it something like this. It's like, here are core questions that I think every college student should think seriously about. So for example, things like, is morality objective or just subjective? Is there a God? How do we think about marriage and family? Should we think about political justice? So think about something like socialism versus libertarianism versus something else. Are we free or are we just like these determined beings? So it's like, hey, I don't care who you are as a college student. If you're thinking seriously about the big questions, these are some questions you should think hard about. So again, in these contexts, in these kind of very pluralistic contexts, I present myself as like, hey, I'm going to be the arbiter of a debate, and I'm very happy to tell you what I think, but that's kind of not the point. The point is to help you think really hard about these issues, right? And to challenge you to think really hard about these things. So if you're thinking about marriage and sexuality in particular, if you tend to be kind of more secular, liberally inclined student that has a view of marriage like the one we were mentioning earlier, then part of my job is going to be to challenge you, right? To take seriously arguments, for example, from the natural law tradition that say that it's not just a matter of faith, but a matter of reason and human nature. That marriage has this intrinsic relationship to children, that marriage has this like key role as a vital cell of society, that this is not just a matter of faith. And by contrast, to students who might have more traditional convictions, on the one hand, I'm giving you the resources to think about some of these issues in a fairly sophisticated way, but I also want to challenge you, right? Because like you will encounter all kinds of things out there, right? And I think the classroom in a university setting is a great place for you to think really hard about ideas that you'd really disagree with, right? And so for all students, right? It's like, hey, if I really disagree with some of these ideas, can I articulate why? Think about our highly polarized culture where people are just talking past each other. Something that I'll often tell students is that you're not in a position to challenge an argument, somebody else's argument, until you could state it just as clearly or more clearly than your opponent would. So it's in such a way that your opponent would say, "Yes, that's my position. You've represented it fairly, right?" I think that that's such a core aspect, I think, of a good philosophical education. And I think it's at the core of how we deal with some of these issues. And in a way, thinking about how you might say politicized or polarizing some of these issues might be, especially issues in marriage and sexuality, I think there's something kind of disarming about approaching it in a philosophical way. Why? Because it's sort of like, okay, you might be very liberal about these things, I might be very conservative about these things, but now we have this kind of common task that we're trying to just understand these arguments, right? And we're both, looking for the truth. And so it's like, okay, let's just really try to understand the traditional argument really well. Let's try to understand the liberal argument really well, and just see if we're getting it right, right? So because I think if we're in the process of seeking the truth with people who are coming from very different places, that's step number one, is kind of both understanding the opponent's position well and understanding your own position well. So I hope this gives you a little bit of a sense for how we've dealt with some of these issues.
No, and that's excellent. I mean, I think Right. Like you said, it's very polarizing to hear, especially if we see like the clips and stuff online and all that. People are just arguing with each other, they're not actually speaking or dialoguing with each other.
Yes.
I'm curious, when you have this like discussion and you provide both sides, I think that's super fascinating and strong also, because you're not just favoring one side and then giving, you know, like you're challenging both. Have you seen, do you have any examples of maybe students who, in the midst of this process of thinking about the facts, let's just say, like, okay, this is what they believe in, that their heart, that their minds are changed, or are they more, you know, set and emotional about their own beliefs that they're like not even budging about it?
Yeah. No, so that's great. So I'll actually, let me come back to answering that question specifically about sexuality, but I want to give some examples, similar examples to a question that's maybe just as polarizing, if only in a different way, is the question about God. So I think, because for several years, I also taught this course on the philosophy of religion, and my approach was exactly the same thing. It's like, look, again, I'm very happy to tell you what I think, but what's my role here? To be the moderator of the debate. And I'm giving you really strong arguments on both sides. And when we're talking about arguments for atheism or whatever, I'm going to defend them as well as I can, right? So because I'm trying to help you take them seriously. So I think one thing that was a kind of common experience in that class was that people, often students, had not heard arguments, theistic arguments, arguments for God, presented in a very serious way. And I think to many students, it was kind of a surprise or a shock, right, to hear that there was such articulate defenses of theistic positions. And it was sort of like, wow, you know, I didn't realize that you could use, you know, reason and science and all these things in the defense of faith. So, you know, maybe, you know, if you're coming from a kind of fairly traditional Catholic background, that's not news, right? But I think in some of these highly, you know, highly secular settings, like, you know, a mainstream secular university the way Rice is, I think that this often is news. So I think what I encountered often in the context of these conversations was students who were just remarkably intellectually honest, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes you had students saying things like, wow, okay, so I guess there must be a God, right? Sometimes you had students saying like, wow, you know, I can't say I believe in God, but I you know, it's a lot more complicated than I thought it was, right? Yeah. So I think that's, to me, that's a win. In a way, kind of complicating the world picture, because the world is complicated, right? I think success. I remember one student telling me once in office hours, she says, like, you know, professor, I'm probably like the average Rice student. You know, she says, I'm liberal, I'm an atheist, I study computer science. And I used to think that everybody thought the way that I did. But now I see that that's very clearly not the case. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, whether you're a religious person or not, that's a win, you know, that's just more in accord with reality, right? Is to recognize that the world is a complicated place, right? And that people who are coming from very different places are, I would venture to say in most cases, not evil or stupid, right? It's like they're just starting from a very different place. Now, coming back to sexuality in particular, so I think in the context of, I think especially in that context of that class dealing with reasonable disagreement, you definitely had students who were very moved by, for example, data about what family structures tend to be best for children, right? So this idea that, you know, moms and dads make a difference for the upbringing of children, best as we can tell, right? So we had, actually for that segment of the course, I had the great privilege and delight of inviting two different thinkers to present that position. So we brought in one philosopher defending the position of marriage between a man and a woman and why this has societal implications for raising children and all these things. And we had another philosopher who was basically defending the position that the state should get rid of marriage, right? And she, but I think with both of them, very intellectually honest, very open to question, very open to challenging the challenges and stuff like this. And I think I definitely remember one student in particular who, in kind of hearing arguments on both sides and thinking about the issues, and not a particularly, you know, traditional student in many ways, he's just like, wow, okay, so I guess it should have a mom and a dad, right? And, and I guess the state does have an interest in this, right? It's like, yeah, you know, maybe if people want to do whatever they want to do sexually, that's fine. But but the government does have an interest in this. So I think, to me, similar to questions about the existence of God, I think if we can create spaces where arguments on various sides are presented fairly, and, you know, not in a kind of like straw man way or things like this, I think we're in a better place in trying to seek the truth, and especially truth about marriage and sexuality. I think another case is a different kind of transformation. So I think there were certainly students who were shocked, right, that when they came to find out, for example, what I thought about these issues. So I think
you played it so good. They couldn't tell.
and in a way,
a great teacher right there.
That was my hope. Yeah. It's like, look, I don't, sometimes, you know, conservatives, complain about, a kind of like left-wing indoctrination going on in colleges or something like this. And whatever you might say about that, I say that because in passing, I think there's a lot of really good people doing really good work at universities, and I don't want to denigrate that, and really good people who might not share your or my convictions, who are doing really thoughtful work in helping these students to think fair-mindedly. But whatever you might say about that, I don't think the answer to quote unquote left-wing indoctrination is right-wing indoctrination, right? It's like the answer to help students to think, right? Yeah. So I think that's part. That's part of the idea.
Yeah, and you mentioned that student that came to you and was like, "Oh, I guess there is. I could see where it's complicated, and there could be a God or whatever." Now they might not know. Like, your students might not understand that it's a philosophical understanding of things. But do they have any philosophical or cultural texts that can resonate with those students? When in the midst of your courses, in the midst of your class, books, and, or, excuse me, sorry, my words are all, do you have any texts that actually students are like, okay, yes, I think I can get behind this, other than just the dialogue aspect?
Yeah, no, good. So actually, you know, maybe this is coming at it from a different angle, but I think, one text that comes to mind, is actually a relatively recent book, so called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. So it's, again, it's coming from a very, somewhat of a different angle than what you're getting at. And it's basically a short history of the sexual revolution. And we ran a reading group on this, on Houston Institute. And I think it's probably one of the most successful reading groups we've ever run. Oh, wow. And, cause part of what the book was doing is it first begins by acknowledging that our kind of social and cultural context with respect to sexuality is remarkably different now than it was, for example, in the early 20th century or before that, right? Mm-hmm. And where basically think about kind of traditional views about sexual morality or stuff like this. So those, as a matter of kind of broad culture, there are so many places where that vision is basically gone. Right. It's like, and the book is trying to understand, okay, whether you think this is good, bad, or indifferent, the author clearly thinks it's a bad thing, but whether you think it's good, bad, or indifferent, can we just try to understand how we got there? Right? Can we just try to understand how we got to a place where things that were once considered just wrong and taboo or whatever are now, you know, celebrated and praised and stuff like this? And I think that resonated very strongly with students. And I think part of the reason, I'm just speculating here, but I think part of the reason is because I think the main thesis of the book is basically right. So the thesis that this author, Carl Truman, is pushing is that part of what explains that radical change in understandings about sexuality is basically a radical reconfiguring of what it means to be a person. You know, so before, and I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but before, you know, we tended to understand the self or what it is to be a person and what it means to live a good life in the context of like conforming ourselves to some outside reality, right? So it's like, if you think about it, you know, we're talking about people like Plato and Aristotle, you know, there's this kind of objective notion of what it means to flourish or be happy, right? And you're going to find your deepest longings kind of satisfied by trying to live virtuously and trying to contribute to your community and trying to know the truth and stuff like this. Or if you think about it in Judeo-Christian context, you know, you find the meaning of your life by conforming to the will of God, right? And that's where you're going to find true meaning and purpose and fulfillment. And basically what this author says is that in one of the results of modernity is that we basically get this radical shift inward. And now all of a sudden I find my deepest meaning by things like expressing my desires or feeling a certain way. And there's this kind of major focus on the subjective. And I think whether students are Christian or not, that's in many ways a cultural default, right? Something like personal satisfaction and, you know, feeling a certain way. And again, not to say that these things don't have value, they certainly do, right? But I think that the worry or the concern is that these things become kind of the be-all and end-all. And I think if you think about that and, you know, connect that up to issues in sexuality, you can begin to see why these things all of a sudden take such a central place and just become really hard to talk about. So I think that narrative, I think, resonated a lot with students, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. And in the midst of your conversations with students, how, you know, you balance very well, like the two different sides by providing both sides, by not, you know, giving one way or the other. How do you encourage those students to balance, you know, their questioning, their understanding of things, that then allows them to be able to kind of think more critically about these concepts of that they're addressing nowadays? Like you spoke about, you know, our ideas of marriage and family life, and even in the 20th century versus now, like how different it is. How have you helped students to kind of balance that? Yeah, those questionings, but then also with understanding just, yeah, both sides, like, I don't know, just kind of this fullness of this whole conversation about, you know, being able to just help these students really kind of embrace different ideas in hopes of, like, I guess, bringing them to truth too also. We don't want to embrace all the ideas and all that stuff, but, you know.
No, that's right. That's right. That's right. And it's a hard balance in part because, you know, you want to respect people's freedom, right? Mm-hmm. And you also... you know, I mentioned this earlier, acknowledge that people are coming from very different places, right? So I think there's a thinker who I really love. This is John Henry Newman. So Newman basically talks about how in coming to assent and coming to say yes to a certain truth, it's most often not, you know, like one master argument that just like blows everything out of the water and just makes it the case. It's usually a combination of a bunch of different things, like this little argument over here, this objection over here, this claim over here. And I think we can also add, of course, there's also all kinds of, like, you know, factors in people's lives that are less related to philosophical arguments. So, so I remember one student, you know, the first semester I taught philosophy of religion, one student who basically at the end of the course is like, oh my gosh, you know, I think I believe in God and I think I should be a Christian. I think there was all kinds of things happening in the classroom, but I think there's also kinds of other things that were happening that were not in the classroom. So I think that she mentioned in a kind of reflection she wrote at the end of the year that, you know, she had one of her friends who was a deeply committed Christian who was kind of like, you know, helping her along and helping her to deal with different things. So it's not, I think argument is absolutely central, but it's not the only thing. And in key cases, it's not the most important thing, right?
Yeah.
But so I think all that to say, so because of factors like this, I think it's so important to always respect people's freedom, right? In many of these questions, but I think it's also helping students to recognize that these ideas have a long history. So I think it's so often the case that we tend to think that where we happen to be and what the cultural defaults happen to be are just it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that one thing that philosophy can help do, and one thing that studying the history of philosophy can help do, is to help us to imagine ourselves in very different places, right? And I think especially when we're thinking about some of these ideas that come from the Christian tradition, you know, that are not widely accepted in secular universities, I think it could just be helpful to help students to consider the possibility, right? It's like, mm-hmm. hey, you know, I'm not asking you to assent to everything that I say, but mm-hmm. I am asking you to take this intellectual possibility seriously. And I think there's something very powerful about that.
And this kind of breaks down the, not so much student thinking, but I'm curious your thoughts, how, because you encourage dialogue amongst your students, whether or not they agree or disagree with each other. Is there anything that you can take from that you would recommend to parents in encouraging their children to develop that sense of like, oh, dialogue? Because I think whether they're going to school or, you know, they're going to face, as you have said, like this, people that think this is just how it is in culture and there's nobody different from me. Like how can parents help guide their children to respect the freedom of others, but then also have this kind of sense of dialogue amongst their own peers?
Yeah, no, that's really great. So I always hesitate giving parenting advice these days, in part because my wife and I just had our first, so so we are very young parents, right? So so I'm going to say something that I think is just true and important about seeking the truth, and I'm going to say something that's straight out of the wonderful work of this organization called Cane Devox, which you might know of. That supports marriage and family, and they're much more practical and experienced than I am in this area. But I think with respect to seeking the truth, I think one thing that's really, really, really important, and that I think was reflected in my own experience as a high schooler, is just this genuine encouragement on the part of parents and teachers to help students ask questions, right? Mm-hmm. So I think this idea of like not pushing it under the rug or stuff like that, because you know, depending on the kid, depending on the student, some of these things can fester, right? Mm-hmm. If we don't address them. And I think recognizing that seeking the truth is in many ways a communal task. So it's not like, hey, parents, you're not supposed to have all the answers, right? You don't, right? But but I think recognizing, okay, who are good mentors? What are good resources? What are good books and articles to read? It'd be good to think about, who are people in your community, right, that can help you to think about some of these issues, especially if you have a kid that by temperament is more inclined to ask questions. I think kids vary widely with respect to their temperaments about these things. But I think, again, the recognition that this truth seeking is a communal affair. You're not doing this on your own. You shouldn't do this on your own. And also recognizing that there's a very long tradition of thinking about these issues, kind of especially in a Catholic context. Oh my goodness, you know. So there's such a long intellectual tradition. You know, you might cite Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun, right? So these things are, there's a lot of resources in helping to think about these questions. So I think that would be part of my advice encourage questions to be asked, and make sure you have good resources, right, to helping to ask those questions. So I think it's also, I don't know how this plays out with children, but a distinction that I remember hearing a philosopher make that I find useful is thinking about two ways in which somebody might ask a question. So somebody could ask a question like a critic, like you're trying to poke holes in an argument or something like this, or somebody could ask a question as a disciple, right? So it's just trying to understand, right? And so I suspect that with teenagers, you're going to look at a little bit of both, right? But you might deal differently with some of those questions, right? Mm-hmm. So that's as far as truth seeking. Now, there's a wonderful, wonderful, very practical advice from the ladies at Cane Devox. So they note that, and I forget exactly what the age range is, but they basically divide out different age ranges and different ways in which you might deal with your children, depending on the age range. So it's something like, you know, from a young age until like, I'm going to butcher this, like age eight or something like this. In a way, you really want to shelter your children. You know, you really want to like give them as much of formation, the truth as you can, because you want them to have a really solid foundation, right? To really know what is true and good. And ages 8 to 14, again, I forget if I'm getting the ages just right, are great age ranges in which to begin to expose your kids to kind of alternative viewpoints, right? Mm-hmm. And to really, as it were, you know, help them to think through some of these alternative possibilities. So that might be more of the age range in which some of what you were asking about applies, right? Yeah. Where it's like, here are peers who think very differently. And it's like, oh, what did Sally say at school? It's like, hey, you know, Mary, how would you respond to this? Or, hey, suppose a kid tells you at school such and so about marriage and family, what would you have to say about this, right? So so that might be a good age range for that. But again, the ladies at Candy Box have much more experience on these things than I do, but I hope that helps.
No, I think you have excellent answers. I mean, you were a college, you know, professor, so you have a lot of experience, and college students sometimes can just be like little kids anyway. So, but this is awesome. And does the Houston Institute have, can you tell us a little bit about, do they have any like resources or anything that, that our listeners might, you know, be encouraged to be able to kind of pursue this conversation a little bit further and look more into how they can either support the Institute or even just have resources for them?
Absolutely. So I would definitely encourage folks to check out our website at houstoninstitute.org, houstoninstitute.org, and to sign up for a newsletter. There you'll hear from us a couple of different times a year about some of the different events that we're doing. So not just stuff for the college students, but especially if you're in the Houston area, check out some of the events that we have for the community. So we have, you know, during the school year, these monthly salons. So we basically invite members of the community to come to the Houston Institute and experience some of the very same things that we do with students. And so we have discussion and, of course, you can have wine with the adults in a way that you can't have with the children. You can also find out about our schedule of public lectures. If you're not in the Houston area, we also record some of our public events, so you can access some of our debates and lectures online as well, in addition to just hear what we're doing. So yeah, please check us out, and we'd love to hear from you.
That's excellent. Wow, thank you. And this is such great work that you guys are doing, and I just love that.
Thank you, Maryse.
You know, encouraging thought and encouraging just dialogue. I think those things are so critical, especially nowadays. So thank you. And thanks for sharing your stories with your students and all the work that you do. We wish you the absolute best as you continue this great project.
Thank you, Mary Grace, and thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, it's been great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ferris Love Podcast. In 2025, we are continuing to share the beautiful devotion to Mary, Mother of Ferris Love, while providing practical tools and advice for parents, couples, and families. You can help us with this mission by sharing this episode with a friend, subscribing to the podcast, or leaving a review. To learn more, visit us at ferrislovefamilyproject.org.